Much higher in the Presidium, in the upper reaches of the chronochasm, the vast, airy space behind the dials where all of the clockwork came together, was a hermetically sealed stone chamber that contained a sixth weight, a sphere of gray metal that rode up and down on a jack screw. This kept the clock ticking while we were winding it. Other than that, it would only move if the meteorite was on the floor, that is, if we failed to celebrate the daily odd of Provener. When this happened, the clock would disengage most of its machinery to conserve energy and would go into hibernation, driven by the slow descent of the sphere, until such time as it was wound again. This had only ever occurred during the three sacks, and on a few other occasions when everyone in the consent had been so sick that they'd not been able to wind the clock. No one knew how long the clock could run in that mode, but it was thought to be on the order of 100 years. We knew it had continued to run all through the time following third sack when the Thousanders had holed up on their crag, and the rest of the consent had been uninhabited for 7 decades. All of the chains ran up into the chronochasm, where they hung from sprockets that turned on shafts, connected by gear trains and escapements that it was the ETA's business to clean and inspect. The main drive chain, the one that ran up the middle and supported the meteorite, was connected to a long system of gear trains and linkages that was artfully concealed in the pillars of the Presidium as it made its way down into the vaulted cellar below our feet. The only part of this visible to non-ETA was a squat hub that rose up out of the center of the chancel floor, looking like a round altar. 4 horizontal poles projected like spokes from this hub at about the height of a person's shoulder. Each pole was about 8 feet long. At the proper moment in the service, Jezri, Arcibalt, Leo, and I each went to the end of a pole and put his hands on it. At a certain beat in the anathem, each of us threw himself behind his pole like a sailor trying to weigh anchor by turning a capstan. But nothing moved except for my right foot, which broke loose from the floor and skidded back for a few inches before finding purchase. Our combined strength could not overcome the static friction of all the bearings and gears between us and the sprocket hundreds of feet above from which the chain and the weight depended. Once it became unstuck, we would be strong enough to keep it going. But getting it unstuck required a mighty thrust, supposing we wanted to use brute force, or if we chose to be clever, a tiny shake, a subtle vibration. Different praxics might solve this problem in different ways. At Santa Edhar, we did it with our voices. Back in very ancient times, when the marble columns of the halls of Orithena still rose from the black rock of Ekba, all the world's theors would gather beneath the great dome just before noon. Their leader, at first a Draconis himself, later Dyax or one of his other fids, would stand on the analemma, waiting for the shaft of light from the oculus to pass over him at midday, a climax celebrated by the singing of the anathem to our mother Hylea, who had brought us the light of her father Canoas. The aught had fallen into disuse when Orithena had been destroyed and the surviving Theors had embarked on the peregrination. But much later, when the Theors retreated to the Maths, St. Cardus drew on it to anchor the liturgy that was then practiced all through the old Mathic age. Again it fell into disuse during the dispersal to the new Periclines and the Praxic age that followed, but then, after the terrible events and the reconstitution, it was revived again in a new form, centered on the winding of a clock. The Hylaean anathem now existed in thousands of different versions, since every composer among the avowed was likely to take at least one crack at it during his or her lifetime. All versions used the same words and structure, but they were as various as clouds. The most ancient were monophonic, meaning each voice sang the same note. The one used at St. Edhar was polyphonic, different voices singing different melodies that were woven together in a harmonious fashion. Those one-offs in their green robes sang only some of the parts. The rest of the voices came out through the screens. Traditionally, the Thousanders sang the deepest notes. Rumor had it they'd developed special techniques to loosen their vocal cords, and I believed it, since no one in our math could sing tones as deep as the ones that rumbled out from their nave.